The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, May 14th, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. On today's show, we begin a preview of the annual Books in Bloom Literary Festival that takes place in Eureka Springs Sunday afternoon from noon to 5. It will feature authors from around the country and around the state. It's an annual fundraiser for the Carroll and Madison County Public Library Foundation. Today, we'll talk with Trenton Lee Stewart, creator of the Mysterious Benedict Society series of books. That's later on today's Ozarks. And after Ozarks at Large, on NPR's Here and Now, 20 years after the last Seinfeld episode aired, the show still resonates. We'll talk with comedian Carol Leifer about her days in the writer's room. Here and Now begins at 1 on 91.3. It's 7 minutes after 12, and we begin this week of Ozarks by looking ahead. The semester-long Housing Northwest Arkansas Initiative, led by the University of Arkansas's Faye Jones School of Architecture and Design, wrapped up this month. The initiative, which focused on the issues of attainable housing in the region, included a design studio for Faye Jones students, a regional symposium involving the community, and then ended with a professional design competition. 125 architecture firms from around the world were invited to participate. About 50 expressed interest, and 25 were chosen to submit designs. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek was there when the winners were announced.
A wooden tower of terraces that are open to the landscape, that are permeable to the climate.
Merritt Buchholz of Buchholz McAvoy Architects explains his firm's competition design during the reception at the Record in Bentonville Thursday evening. By permeable, Buchholz means the building has holes that allow air to move through it, kind of like breezeways.
It's really important that we use less energy, and we need to build in a way that automatically uses less energy. In other words, where we don't have to turn on the heating, we don't have to have air conditioning.
Buchholz says it's cheaper to build with the climate instead of against it. And that was a key component of his Dublin, Ireland-based firm's design.
Bentonville has a great climate. You can live outdoors most of the year. Okay, it gets really hot and it gets really cold, but most of the rest of the year, it's amazing. So apartments built at a massive scale like this, up high in the sky, need to already be part of that climate landscape.
The competition focused on attainable housing, which is defined as households making 60 to 120% of an area's median income. According to the competition brief sent to all participating architecture practices, the median income in Northwest Arkansas 3 years ago was nearly $51,000, but average annual wages were about $44,000, a demographic that typically doesn't qualify for government-subsidized housing but may still struggle to find affordable housing in the region. And that was part of the challenge, creating innovative designs for mixed-income and mixed-use housing that cuts down on construction costs and construction time. That's why Buchholz says his firm was thinking about flexibility in their design, where the interior space of the apartment takes up about 60% of the floor plan.
The rest of it is, at the moment, outdoors, or could be also eventually indoors by pulling a screen over. So this means that this unit, which has 2 bedrooms, could become a 3-bedroom unit.
Buchholz says they also thought hard about what their building would be made out of. They went with mass timber construction, which he says is a much faster way of building than using wood framing.
Because all of that has to be clad after you finish the structure. You have to go and put sheetrock on it. You have to put in the electrical services. With this system, you don't have to do any of that stuff. You just put it up and it's done. You don't have to paint it. You don't have to sheetrock it. You don't have to do anything.
And most importantly, Buchholz says mass timber construction doesn't sacrifice quality and durability in order to build quickly. His firm was designing for what is known as Site 4, a 5-acre plot of land on John DeShields Boulevard and Central Avenue. Faye Jones School of Architecture and Design Dean Peter McKeith says Site 4 was also the one exception in the competition.
With the exception of Site 4, where the jury could not come to a consensus, and according to the competition rules, threw it back to me as the arbiter, And I determined, together with our competition advisors, to award two commendations for entries within Site 4.
The other four sites in Bentonville each had an individual winner. The competition included 25 architecture practices, five per each of the five sites picked as good candidates for attainable housing developments. The winning architects were then flown into Bentonville. McKeith says the goal there was to facilitate the next step of the competition, taking the ideas from paper to actual buildings on the ground.
And what we've done now today is to organize an introduction session between our winning architects, who most of whom are here, and the community of developers, realtors, people in the banking community, people in the municipal cities communities, architectural communities, something of an introduction session to begin to close the gap between the design ideas for the competition is producing and the realization of those ideas through those eventual partnerships.
McKeith says he also sees the competition as an idea generator and a way to encourage the region to realize the potential for attainable housing that's not only affordable but well-designed.
So that if there are great unit plans, if there are great building organizations, if there are great ideas about public spaces, if there are great ideas about how to obtain density in ways that are sensitive to the context of a community, that those are transferable to Fayetteville, to Rogers, to Springdale, to Siloam Springs, to all of our communities in Northwest Arkansas.
McKeith says he was impressed by the passion put into each of the 25 entries, even though the firms are not guaranteed any kind of return on their investment.
Each of these entries represents untold hours of an architectural practice, potentially on the order of $100,000 of design expertise.
McKeith says for him, that indicates others see Northwest Arkansas as a place that still has the potential to design its way out of the housing issues other growing cities are experiencing.
And what we're seeing is that there is this incredible interest from outside the state in what we're doing here, and a belief that they can contribute on to the region on the basis of their experience from Philadelphia, from New York, From Los Angeles, from Portland, from Winnipeg in Canada, Dublin in Ireland, from Oslo in Norway, Mexico City. What is very clear is that these are issues of common cause to us all, irrespective now of where we live.
And Merritt Buchholz says a lack of attainable housing is certainly an issue in Dublin. When his firm was invited to enter the competition, he says they noted there was a lot happening in Bentonville.
But what was really striking to us was the sheer scale of what was being proposed as against what's actually here. What I mean by that is, as far as housing goes in Bentonville, what you see are houses, not housing. So here is a proposal to make housing, but not just housing, like three-story apartment blocks or townhouses, but on a massive scale.
Buchholz says they felt the competition could allow the firm to push the envelope on low-energy building and timber-based construction. And while it would be great if their design was built, Buchholz says the competition was about more than that.
It's about the design starting a really great conversation about a new way of building, about a new way of delivering affordable housing, about a new way of addressing climate change, about a new way of addressing transportation, about a new way of addressing age and generation change. All these things kind of come into it.
Because, Buchholz says, those are the issues we're facing around the globe. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzanna Sitek.
The Housing Northwest Arkansas Initiative was funded through a grant from the Walton Family Foundation. Images can be seen at ozarksatlarge.com.
KUAF is giving away general admission wristbands to Rocklahoma 2018, May 25th through the 27th in Pryor, Oklahoma. Over 60 rock acts will perform, including Candlebox, Seven Dust, and Clutch. Winners announced Friday, May 18th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information at KUAF.com. The 18th Annual Art of Wine Festival, presented by Walton Arts Center, is June 8th and 9th. This two-evening event will feature the Uncorked Wine Tasting on Friday at 7 p.m., and the Winemaker's Dinner Saturday evening at 6. A limited number of tickets are available for each event. Tickets and information at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600.
In about 1 minute on Ozarks, we find out if Trenton Lee Stewart the creator of the New York Times best-selling series, The Mysterious Benedict Society, was at all influenced by his childhood in Hot Springs. He'll be at Books in Bloom in Eureka Springs Sunday afternoon and with us on Ozarks at Large just ahead. And in our second half hour, the Fort Smith Symphony season may have just ended this past weekend, but John Jetter, the conductor, is already thinking about next season.
We, for this coming year, particularly want to reach out to people who've never been to the symphony. It's time to come. People who maybe just attend a few concerts, it's time to consider buying season tickets. It's time to emulate so many of those other folks who, yes, get their symphony season brochure, and they go to their calendars, and they write in the dates. And it's amazing how many people tell us, we work around as much as we can symphony schedule.
That's later on today's Ozarks at Large. The Mysterious Benedict Society is a series of books that has attracted attention for more than a decade. The books concentrate on four children and the puzzle-solving collective they form, inspired by an enigmatic figure named Mr. Benedict. Each of the children feels somewhat rejected, orphaned, or shunned by society. Fortunately, they come together to save the world from the evil clutches of villains. Along the way, Trenton Lee Stewart, the author, gives us puzzles, puns, and riddles. Trenton Lee Stewart will be speaking Sunday afternoon at the Books in Bloom Literary Festival in Eureka Springs. His 1 o'clock talk at the Crescent Hotel is titled Sidewalks and Driveways, Where I Got My Ideas for the Mysterious Benedict Society and How I Use Them. Trenton grew up in Hot Springs, and he still lives in Little Rock. Last week, we reached him and asked him about ideas and whether growing up in a place like Hot Springs contributed to the eventual Mysterious Benedict Society.
I don't know if I thought of Hot Springs in particular as a mysterious place when I was a kid. It seems more mysterious now looking back than it did when I was growing up, but I still thought it was really an interesting place. My parents still live there, and I get there from time to time. So it's definitely a curious place, and I do have to wonder if my childhood there led me to having a certain feel for certain kinds of atmospherics. And I definitely have memories from when I was a kid of days when I'd be playing with a neighbor's dog or something. And there's something about the neighborhood or my environment that created a certain kind of feeling of mystery. But that could have been childhood anywhere. I'm not sure. But certainly I read all the books that I loved when I was a kid in Hot Springs, and I tried to write books like those books that I loved as an adult. So there's got to be some kind of attachment there, but I've never tried to puzzle it out.
You mentioned that the books you loved, and what were the books that you loved?
Well, I loved a lot of books, and I read pretty much everything, but for kids at least. But the ones that stood out to me that sort of took over my dreams, and those were the kinds of books that I tried to write myself all these years later. They were big adventures with small heroes and mysterious elements. So like the Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe was probably the first one like that, though most of the Chronicles of Narnia, I think, sort of swept me away. And then The Hobbit and Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. I was a little bit older, but still young when I read Watership Down. Mm. So all of those books, I think, probably had a pretty big influence on mine.
The Mysterious Benedict Society and the series and now the prequel that all came, when did that start to form for you? Was that something you had carried for a while and then started to put down on paper?
I think unwittingly I was carrying pieces of that puzzle without realizing I was carrying a puzzle around. So once I noticed that they belonged to something, then it happened pretty fast. So it was really in the early 2000s, and I'd been working on fiction for adults for quite some time, and I'm sort of between projects. And right around that time, I had my older son Elliot was really young at the time. I was telling him stories every day, and I had in mind that I would probably try to write a book for him someday when he was old enough to read. All of those things were probably thrown into the percolator in some way, but I started to realize that things that I would daydream about really had no bearing on the kind of stuff that I was trying to write at the time. And in some way, it felt a little bit like I was wasting my idle time. I ought to be daydreaming more productively somehow. And I think all those things led me to start really paying attention to some of the elements I was daydreaming about. Like, I remember being in a driveway outside my house when I had the idea of a test that had a secret to it. It was more than it appeared to be. And I knew what it was, and I wondered about the kid who would be taking it and why. And within a few weeks of that time, I had a chess riddle occur to me, kind of out of the blue. And so that really got me thinking, well, where would these things belong if I actually did write a story that involved these kinds of elements that I'm amusing myself with? And that's what ended up leading me. At that point, once I sat down with those different elements and started asking those questions, that led me pretty quickly into writing that book.
What are the elements that go into making relatable young characters that relate to people of around the same age who are reading about them?
Good question. I say it like that because I had never done anything like that myself when I sat down to do it. I hadn't spent most of my adult life trying to write for kids. And I really had to just sort of follow my instincts. So I didn't know who my readership was in the present world. So I tried to write a story that would have appealed to me when I was 11 or 12, and I felt like I had a pretty good memory for that. And I looked back at some of those books that I loved and read passages from them, but I had pretty strong memory of things about them that I loved. And so I was trying to recreate those elements. But as for the characters themselves, I remember distinctly being 12 years old and recognizing that I was having thoughts that I thought were more like adult thoughts than like kid thoughts, even though I still thought of myself as a kid, but not really necessarily feeling like adults knew that maybe adults tended to forget that at age 12 you already started thinking on a more sophisticated level. And I promised myself I wouldn't forget that when I was an adult. And I think because I made that effort to make the promise to myself, it helped me never to forget that moment. And so I felt like maybe there was a little bit of a tunnel through time for me back to that kid who was that age. And so I really just sort of tried to channel what it would have been like for me or people I was close to in this kind of situation at that age. So the typical kind of questions that pertain, like, what am I doing with myself? Where do I fit in? Am I well understood by people around me? And am I understood by myself? And all of those things then kind of coalesce when given a larger-than-life kind of mission, I think, for my characters.
My favorite stories from going back when I was a kid reading Spider-Man, and he would face Dr. Octopus or the Green Goblin, up through Cruella de Vil, you got to have interesting, perhaps even enigmatic henchmen or bad guys. And the Ten Men mm-hmm. hit that. I mean, where did you develop that idea?
Well, I'm glad you think so. Well, it started with the first book. So I have the characters, the recruiters. A lot of this stuff came out of jokes. So the kids go on this mission where they have to infiltrate a school where there'll be students, but there'll also be secret agents. But this school is supposed to be appealing to very talented, the very enlightened is in the name of the institute. But there's subterfuge there and deceit there. And so there are people that need kids at that school for their own nefarious reasons. And if the kids don't sign up, if they don't buy into the deceit, in some cases, they're flat out kidnapped. And so I thought, who are these bad, scary guys who are going to be kidnapping these kids? And then I thought, well, we're talking about an institute. We'll make them recruiters. That's what we'll call them. And so they'll wear nice suits and they'll be friendly and have nice smelling cologne and just make for a very appealing picture for prospective students. But then it turns out they'll shock you with, you know, electric wires from their watches and stuff you in a bag if the opportunity arises. So it was meant to be a sort of dark joke about people trying to get you to do the things they want you to do in this world and go to their school and come to their company. And then in the subsequent books, though, the Institute is no longer part of the story. But I tried to use things that I had created in the first book and see if I could find ways to, you know, make them work in a new way in the later books. So they were no longer recruiters, but they were still these same kinds of guys. And I thought, since I started out with these guys who had what we call shock watches, why not just complete the picture? They're well dressed. They carry briefcases. They look like businessmen, and so they have all these things that would make them blend in a room full of well dressed businessmen. But in fact, they have all their nice accoutrements are weapons. So super sharp pencils and neckties that they can use as whips and things like that. I think to a degree, it was just an attempt to be scary but playful at the same time. My editor has a really good sense of this kind of sensibility for kids, I think. And she suggested in the first draft that I wrote, The Mysterious Benedict Society, I had bad guys show up with guns. And she said, you know, I think it's better usually if you have your characters can be scary, but it's better if they're scary with stuff that's not, doesn't feel as real in certain ways, so that it helps kids to be scared but also feel safe at the same time to a degree. And I thought that made perfect sense, and that's what took me off down the road of making shock watches and these other kinds of silly, while at the same time being scary kind of weapons for these bad guys.
Yeah, I mean, I have no desire to be on the wrong end of a shock watch. It may not be a
Nor
gun,
do I.
But it doesn't sound very fun.
Right. No, and it isn't.
You talk to your readers a lot, and I'm wondering, I'm guessing that a lot of them are meeting an author, a published author of a book they like for maybe the first time. Do you ever get an idea of that?
Sure, yeah.
What's that like for them, and what's that like for you?
It is, it's really rewarding. It's the best part of meeting people that have in any kind of capacity has to do with the books, because most of being a writer is being alone and working on the story, and that's what got me interested, and that's what I love. I wasn't really interested in doing book tours, which is what happens with kids' books, is you don't just go into bookstores and do a reading, but you go to schools and you give talks to kids, and that means you have to meet a lot of people, and if you're introverted at all, that's exhausting. But still, I knew that I was really wanting to write a book that kids would love, but nothing can really prepare you for meeting a kid who loves your book. And that something about the expression in a bright boy or girl's face, you know, when they're meeting you, and they're just so excited, it's moving. And I think I'm over the surprise now after all these years, but it's still really touching. It's the best part. There are a lot of kids who take it for granted that they actually go to these schools and have lots of resources and they bring in lots of writers. So they've met plenty of writers. But every time I do any kind of public events, there's always some kid that is there just because this is their chance to meet the author of a book that they love, and they're excited. And it's a pretty wonderful thing.
Trenton Lee Stewart is the author of books in the Mysterious Benedict Society. His first book in that series was on the New York Times bestseller list for more than a year. He'll deliver the talk, Where I Got My Ideas for the Mysterious Benedict Society and How I Use Them, Sunday afternoon as part of the Books in Bloom Literary Festival taking place on the grounds of the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. It's an annual fundraiser for the Carroll and Madison County Public Library Foundation. You can find a schedule for the festival at booksinbloom.org. You can learn much more about Trenton Lee Stewart at mysteriousbenedictsociety.com. He lives in Little Rock. And later this week, we'll meet a few other authors who will be at Books in Bloom this weekend. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Additional support comes from CFA Society Arkansas, promoting the highest standards of ethics, education, and professional excellence in the investment management industry. More at cfasociety.org/Arkansas.
There are many ways people decide when it's summer. First time that the temperatures bump into the lower 90s, well, it's already arrived for many of us. Maybe it's when school's out, so just right around the corner. Or maybe you go by the old summer equinox. That means it's a little bit more than a month away. No matter when summer arrives for you, if you're making plans, may we suggest a short trip across the Arkansas border to the Golden Pioneer Museum. Technically, it's just off Route 86 and County Road J. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, this Ozarks attraction may be obscure, but it contains an astonishing collection of historic artifacts, specimens, and just plain old collectibles.
The Golden Pioneer Museum was founded by an Ozarks couple passionate about local history and beautiful objects.
Winfred Pryor. I live in Golden, Missouri. I run the Golden Pioneer Museum here in Golden, and we've been here 24 years.
Pryor, a native of Eagle Rock, Missouri, 6 miles west along the White River, is married to Leona, a native of Grandview, Arkansas, for 54 years. As newlyweds, the couple collected historic and heirloom items, building a museum in the early 90s after purchasing collections from a Frontier History Museum in Oklahoma and a Trail of Tears Museum in Huntsville, both which had gone out of business.
We add on a building every 2 or 3 years, you know, get something else to put in.
The 13,000-square-foot museum contains 200 displays. Everything is beautifully arranged, protected, and well illuminated.
That little old display right there, you can't believe what that is. That's meteorites.
The museum also has a vast terrestrial collection, starting with 10,000 arrowheads and spear points from prehistoric to early settlement. The Pryors also acquired 800 pieces of intact pottery, much of it unearthed decades ago before it became illegal, from Ozark burial grounds, along with woven baskets, tribal jewelry, stone, and bone tools.
Those are peace medallions that the presidents would give Indian chiefs when they'd sign a treaty with them. Of course, we broke all the treaties, but those are real rare, and I've got about 10 of them.
Among the indigenous artifact cases are pioneer relics, a covered wagon, cast iron stove, animal traps, weapons, ammunition, cannonballs, colonial-era derringers, one similar to the handgun which killed President Lincoln, antique rifles, and even tribal shotguns from the Pine Ridge, South Dakota Reservation.
See the little brass tacks on it? That was an Indian rifle. And there's three of them in here.
Winfred Pryor is an avid hunter and gun collector, so his museum houses lots of World War I and II relics. He points to a box filled with what looks like to be solid stainless steel-shaped torpedoes.
Look like little bombs, about, what, inch and a half, 2 inches long, and they're steel. And they had those open airplanes back in the early 1900s. They keep buckets of them in their airplanes, and they'd fly over troops. They'd just throw a bucket at them little bombs out. They're no explosive, they're just solid steel. And that would fall right down on the person. They're heavy enough that they'd go through a helmet.
The museum also displays a peculiar collection of trench art, fabricated metal pieces made in the trenches by World War I troops, from enemy artillery shell casings, buttons, badges, and helmets. But Winfred and Leona Pryor specialize in collectible glass, over 30 varieties. One case held a glittering display of amberette glass manufactured in the late 1800s, frosted chalices, bowls, bottles with golden crossings and bands issued during the Great Alaskan Gold Rush.
Over 15,000 pieces of glass. Got the largest carnival glass collection in this part of the United States.
The museum has case after case of Northwood, Tiffany, Hawks, Tuthill, Fenton, as well as two types of uranium glass. One is custard or buttermilk glass, the opaque, creamy color achieved by adding uranium salts to molten hot glass. Another type, a pale translucent jade green glass manufactured in the 1800s, when placed under an ultraviolet light, grows brilliant lime green, says Leona Pryor.
It's called Vaseline glass.
Named after the petroleum jelly, supposedly because the glassware has an oily sheen. The museum houses several valuable collections of Vaseline dinnerware, pitchers, butter dishes, even in dark cases, and several small rooms equipped with black light switches.
Oh, there it comes. Something in there that makes them fluoresce, the minerals.
A little research here. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission assessed the health risks associated with Vaseline glass in 2001, reporting it to be less harmful than the background radiation levels. So you can eat ice cream out of those vivid green bowls. And just for fun, Wilfred Pryor has more than 1,500 glass toothpick containers and the world's largest collection, he says, of glass auto vases, originally placed in luxury Oldsmobile, Packard, Pierce, Arrow, and Rolls-Royce vehicles.
Put roses or flowers in it for an aroma in the car.
The Golden Pioneer Museum also displays valuable coins, paper currency, and fossils, including a giant lepidodendron, an extinct primitive vascular tropical wetland plant, part of the coal forest flora, dug out of a Huntsville Creek, along with a mastodon tusk and a 300-pound femur bone from a brontosaurus discovered in Cushing, Oklahoma. Prior shows us one large white fossil containing 29 eggs set out for patrons to touch.
People don't believe it, but that's a dinosaur nest. Did you know dinosaurs come from eggs?
And what do dinosaurs make? Well, it's here in the museum.
Petrified, fossilized dinosaur poop. But this is prehistoric stuff.
The museum also contains lots of really amazing mineral specimens, massive pieces of white and rose selenite from Mexico, quartz crystals from the Ouachitas, and raw turquoise. Winfred Pryor says he has no idea, nor apparently any interest in what his museum's collections are worth. For him, it's about sharing beauty and history.
20 years ago, we decided to charge, you know, a little bit, $2 or $3, but people wouldn't come in.
To tour the Golden Pioneer Museum only requires a donation.
We get a lot of $10 and $20 bills. Got a 50 or two, and just 3 or 4 days ago, a woman gave her a $100 bill.
Word about the museum is spreading, with patrons driving from as far away as Texas. The museum is open April through November, Tuesday through Saturday, 10:30 to 4:30. Florence, the museum's kind docent, will meet you in the lobby. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you want to know more about the Golden Pioneer Museum, we have links with this or really any other story or interview that you hear on Ozarks at Large at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. There, you can also listen to past editions of the show, past stories that you might have missed or interviews. You can also share those links with folks through email and social media. The Arkansas Razorback softball team will, for the first time ever, host an NCAA regional title beginning this weekend. The team is the national 13 seed in the NCAA tournament and will host a regional at Bogle Park on the U of A campus beginning Friday afternoon. Oklahoma State will face Wichita State at 1:30. Arkansas then meets DePaul at 4. The double elimination tournament will send one team into the super regionals later this month against the winner of the regional that's being played this weekend in Norman, Oklahoma. The Razorback baseball team could win the SEC West regular season title this weekend in Athens, Georgia. Number 6 Arkansas ended the regular season home schedule with a sweep of number 20 Texas A&M this past weekend at Baum Stadium. Any combination of 3 Arkansas wins against Georgia or 3 Mississippi losses this approaching weekend will give the Razorbacks the SEC West championship. The SEC tournament then will begin play on May 22nd. The season is over for the University of Arkansas Fort Smith baseball team. The Lions lost at the Heartland Conference tournament this weekend to end their season with a 32-19 record. The Arkansas men's track and field team now will concentrate on the NCAA West preliminary meet that's later this month. That's after finishing 3rd at the SEC meet this weekend. The women's team ended up 6th at the SECs. And the Arkansas men's golf team opens play in an NCAA regional in Norman, Oklahoma today. The top 5 teams in that field of 14 will then advance to the NCAA championships later this month. The Razorback women's golf team, ranked 3rd in the country, has already qualified for the NCAA championships after winning this month's regional in Austin, Texas. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. It is time to talk about next year's Fort Smith Symphony season. And to do that, John Jetter, who is a conductor and music director of the Fort Smith Symphony, is with me. Is it time?
Totally. You nailed it. It's time to talk about the Fort Smith Symphony's 2018-19 season. And it literally is its time, as that is our slogan for next season. We love all of our concert attendees. We love our subscribers. We have so many people who have been coming to the orchestra for years and years and years, and it's great. We, for this coming year, particularly want to reach out to people who've never been to the symphony It's time to come. People who maybe just attend a few concerts, it's time to consider buying season tickets. It's time to emulate so many of those other folks who, yes, get their symphony season brochure, and they go to their calendars, and they write in the dates. And it's amazing how many people tell us, we work around as much as we can symphony schedule. Really? You know, and yes, it is an absolute perfect season to enjoy us. And of course, if you're a longtime supporter, I think you're going to feel the same way. We have probably the most consistently excellent lineup of guest artists we've ever had. And we are responding, I think, as well as we have ever been to our audience's interest in hearing lots of different type of music, performing lots of different types of works, actually within one concert. So it's a real mixed bag of concerts. Our guest artists include Jubilant Sykes.
Well, yes, and the first concert is titled It's Time for Jubilation.
That's right.
And Jubilant Sykes is this amazing singer.
He's an amazing singer, and he's on our classic season opener. However, he'll be doing music by Aaron Copland. He's going to do some Nat King Cole, and he's going to sing some American spirituals, because one of the things that Jubilant is known for is his versatility. He's a terrific concert singer and operatic singer, but he's great singing, I guess you could say popular, the American songbook, things like that.
I'm as restless as a willow in a windstorm, jumpy as a puppet on a string. I'd say that I spring fever, but I know it isn't spring.
He has an amazing charisma as well as an amazing voice.
He does. And there was, maybe 6 years ago, it ended up, he was kind of, I don't remember exactly, he was in the neighborhood sort of or whatever, and we had him come and sing a little bit with us at Christmas. And, you know, part of it is people talk about that all the time. When is he going to come back?
Yeah. Well, so now we know.
So, yeah, and he'll be great on our opening concert. A Time for Three is, they're just great.
It's They've been in here
trio.
As well, yeah.
Yeah, they are the busiest, along with maybe the Canadian Brass, are like the busiest symphonic pops group now. They're great. They'll be performing with us, sort of a mixed bag of everything from music from Hamilton to some Mahler. We'll do our sort of traditional slash non-traditional Christmas, which is a very mixed bag of everything from music of Miklos Rosa to, I think we're doing a extended suite from the film The King of Kings with chorus. It's it's typical golden era orchestral music. It's just great. We had such a great response from performing the Ten Commandments, music from the Ten Commandments, and Ben-Hur this previous Christmas, that we're adding sort of the biblical reference to Christmas concert, as well as popular Christmas pieces. January, we're doing performing Charlie Chaplin's score to his wonderful film City Lights. And I'm really happy to be doing that concert, because already in talking with people, particularly younger people, there's a lot of enthusiasm. And then you hear other people say, well, that's not in black and white, is it? Yes, it is. And it's a silent film. Oh, bleh. You know, of course you have to go. I mean, it's really there's so much from that era that's just terrific film music. It's great. It's great. Tony Desserre is a wonderful pianist and a vocalist. He's also one of the most prominently busy guest artists on the symphony circuit today. He'll be performing with us in April. A great mix, everything from Elton John to, you know, jazz.
That's the classics. It's Time for Piano.
That's It's Time for Piano. Yes, it's Time for Jubilation. It's Time for Three. It's Time for Christmas. It's Time for Chaplin. It's Time for Piano. And then May is It's Time for Pictures.
Motion pictures?
No. Pictures at an exhibition.
Ah.
Yeah, we're going to be performing a world premiere dubstep piece for orchestra. We did...
Oh, not another one of those.
Yes. Well, we did a piece at Earquake a few years ago. Same composer, but he's planning a really huge project for basically like a dubstep symphony. There's a lot of interest in it.
Okay. I like this.
And it'll be a double concerto for clarinet and violin. The original, our first version a few years ago was triple concerto. And as they move forward, they're going to do this great piece. Michael McHale who I think has been in the studios here, mm-hmm. a pianist mm-hmm. From Ireland. He'll be performing Prokofiev's third piano concerto. And then we will be performing pictures in an exhibition, the Mazursky Revel. However, we are partnering with The Unexpected, 64-6, to create new
murals?
Artwork.
Yes. All right.
For those of you who know and love Pictures in an Exhibition, it was originally a piano piece by Mazursky, inspired by paintings, miniature paintings by a friend, Victor Hartmann. And of course, the idea is, in the piece, it's someone going through an art exhibition. They're seeing these paintings, and it's their reaction. Fine. So, years later, Maurice Ravel, like many composers, loved the piano work and thought, boy, it's so colorful. There's so much there. I think I need to make an orchestral piece out of it. And many people, an orchestral arrangement. In this day and age, the Mazursky Revel Pictures in an Exhibition really has a totally separate life of its own. And for those of us who love it and maybe take the opportunity to look at the paintings that inspired it, you're listening to this huge orchestral piece. And then in all due respect to Victor Hartmann, you look at these small miniatures and you go, really, that's the Great Gate of Kiev? What a disappointment. Or, you know, that's, yeah, they don't match. The paintings don't match the you know, what Pictures at an Exhibition has become today.
Right.
So we thought it'd be a wonderful thing to do, and they'll be unveiled at the concert. And of course, it's such a big Technicolor piece that you need murals to be able to make it work.
They'll be unveiled at the concert?
Yes.
So these aren't going to be on the sides of buildings?
No.
Okay.
They're going to be, you know, they'll be at the actual, we're still working out.
Okay.
There'll be probably a combination of actually these big murals. There might be even a few artists might want to do something more in the video realm to do this. And we're just basically, we're working on which artists, and it's going to be, can you do this movement? Can you do this movement? And I think it's a real neat way to revisit all this. And then in addition to that, of course, we're doing Earquake. And
Earquake brings classical music to elementary age students.
Yeah, to sixth graders, about 4,000 sixth graders. And that program has just been going so well. It's so much fun. Full orchestra, three concerts. And then we're of course, still doing the Cool Cats Jazz Quartet and Symphony in the Schools. We do have a new group for third graders called the Wind Wizards, and it's a woodwind quintet. And the idea is taking the theme of talking about the magic and mystery of music. And with woodwind instruments, one of the neat things you can do with them is you can play on them in all sorts of different configurations. You know, you can take a clarinet apart and play on the different parts of the instrument. You can take these instruments apart and you can play them in different ways. So we want to highlight the beauty of woodwind instruments, but also how quirky they can be and how fun they can be. And they're just, you know, there's so much you can do playing with the instrument. So I think that's going to be a fun addition to what we're doing.
Where can people find out so much more information about next season?
Well, season tickets are now available at fortsmithsymphony.org. And we're in the process of people who are renewing their season tickets. Their seats are currently being held online.
Gotcha.
And then for those who want, if they're new season ticket holders, they can purchase season tickets of what's available. And all the information will be on there. Again, it's fortsmithsymphony.org.
Well, thanks for giving us the preview, and best of luck.
Thank you.
John Jetter is the musical director and conductor of the Fort Smith Symphony. This is a Monday edition of Ozarks at Large.
Walton Arts Center presents the 9th annual Artisphere, Arkansas's Arts and Nature Festival, June 10th through the 23rd. It will feature dozens of events, including the Artisphere Festival Orchestra and Chapel Music Series, along with Trail Mix, a new film series, and more. Artispherefestival.org for tickets and full festival event lineup.
And this is Ozarks at Large.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. On our report today, a meat technology company in Jerusalem has caught the attention of Tyson Foods. We will also hear from Leticia Sanders of Maumelle. She's one of two candidates hoping to win the Democratic nomination for governor later this month. And a Bentonville developer has announced plans for a $6 million residential project near the city's downtown square. That's all ahead today on the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom provides communications options to help your business adapt to today's demands with tomorrow's technology. With opportunities in virtualization, redundancy, or maximizing your efficiency. Learn more at onecom.com. That's one-comm.com.
Tyson Ventures, the venture capital arm of Tyson Foods in Springdale, has led a $2.2 million seed investment round in Future Meat Technologies. That's a biotech company based in Jerusalem. And no, that's not Jerusalem, Arkansas. This Jerusalem is just a little further east, near the Dead Sea. Future Meat Technologies is based at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. The company is working to develop a distributive manufacturing platform for the cost-efficient non-GMO production of meat directly from animal cells, without the need to raise or harvest animals. Tyson Foods Chief Sustainability Officer Justin Whitmore said the company will continue to invest significantly in its traditional meat business, but it will also explore opportunities for growth that, quote, gives consumers more choices. Tyson Foods did not disclose the amount of its investment. Last Thursday on the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report, we heard from Jared Henderson of Little Rock, who is seeking the Democratic nomination to challenge Republican incumbent Governor Asa Hutchinson this fall. Jared is a Springdale High School grad, by the way, 1997, I believe. Today we will hear from Henderson's primary opponent, a Hall High School graduate in Little Rock, Leticia Sanders of Maumelle, which is a suburb just outside the capital city. Sanders is a 42-year-old hairdresser and a graduate student at Webster University. She surprised the political establishment by plopping down her $12,000 filing fee in cash during the waning moments of the filing period on March 1st. Sanders said she has been thinking about running for governor since February 2017. Here's a portion of her conversation with Roby Brock.
Let's talk about some positions that you may have as a governor's candidate here. Pro-life, pro-choice, where do you fall on the issue of abortion?
Kind of both. I wish that our women wouldn't abort their children, mm-hmm. but under the circumstances, we don't know what kind of circumstances lie for them. But what I believe, the only way they should be giving their babies up if it's detrimental to the health or if they've been raped. Mm-hmm. That's my concerns. Now, just having children and wanting to abort them because you feel like you can't take care of them, well, you should have been more responsible about what you were doing to prevent that. Mm-hmm. And you need to be more preventive if you don't want them babies that you know you can't take care of, because then that put a burden on the system. You know, now you're looking for the government to help you for something you knew already that you couldn't do. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I enforced in my kids. And my older two, they don't have children. And that was one of the things I wanted them to be prepared of, is making sure when they bring a life into the world that they are financially stable so that they wouldn't have to depend on the government.
What about the death penalty? Would you carry out the death penalty if you
totally against of it? When we're looking at the death penalty, it's more of being playing the role of God. Everybody have the right. Everyone make mistakes, and we don't know the circumstances. And when you're doing the death penalty, are we analyzing was that cause for self-defense? So that don't be analyzed as much as, oh, he murdered someone. It's two sides to every story, and the one that died is not able to tell the story, only the one that's alive. And we don't consider the circumstances. So, no, I wouldn't be for the death penalty. I will be in keeping them incarcerated, not being eligible for parole. If it's found that it was a hate act or something that could have been prevented, it's something that people, we need to be able to de-escalate the situations, and it shouldn't be more of pulling a gun to resolve the solution.
Let's talk taxes. There's a lot of conversation going on at the state capitol about cutting taxes. There's some conversation about maybe shifting some, if you do some tax cuts, maybe you raise some taxes in some other areas or enforce some taxes in some other areas. What's your position on tax cuts, tax increases? What would you do if you were governor?
Well, I wouldn't be looking to increase taxes. I feel that, like the first draft of the Constitution said, that individuals shouldn't be directly taxation. So my goal is to alleviate some of the imposed taxes that are on the people. And two of my concerns is the property tax. Once an individual have paid their property off, I don't feel that they should be obligated to still be paying property tax. It defeats the purpose of them being a homeowner. It's kind of say, hey, you got your name on the title, but I can always come back and get it.
Where would you make up that difference in revenue, though? I mean, that brings a lot of money in for local school districts and stuff like that. Would they just have to learn to tighten their belts?
No. Well, that's what the recreational of tax of 21 and older come in place. It's a state that uses it, if I'm not mistaken, Washington or Massachusetts. What
about recreational marijuana?
Correct.
Right, okay. So you would maybe advocate recreational marijuana with a tax burden on it to make up for property tax cuts.
Right, and it's not a tax that would be enforced on every individual. It's just the ones that, I guess, will want that. Mm-hmm. So It's for helping the special projects as far as the roads, allocating money to the farmers, because I'm interested in helping the farmers produce organic foods, and that will help out a lot. I've seen, I've not seen, but I've actually did a research on Colorado and in Washington and how much it prospered that state off just the recreational tax. But that recreational tax is kind of different from what I'm trying to put in place. They tax is based off 15% to 28% off of the marijuana project itself, and not just up front saying, okay, well, here's this tax. And then mine is up front, where I will have it to where I designated for RT, so recreational tax will automatically be on your driver license. And it's a tax that would be paid every year. If that's what you want, it'll help you as far as being in trouble with the law, so they won't be arresting the people just on a non-toxic stimulant, which is the most safest thing. We look at marijuana as a problem, but we're not looking at alcohol that we know scientifically takes a person out of their character and make them do things that they wouldn't normally do under the circumstance of the influence.
And that's Leticia Sanders speaking with Roby Brock about her primary campaign to be Arkansas's next governor. You can hear the entire interview at talkbusiness.net. Finally today, the development projects in and around downtown Bentonville just keep on coming. The latest is from Bentonville firm Newell Development, which has broken ground on a $6 million residential project at the corner of 6th and B Streets, just southwest of the downtown square. The project is called Depot No. 16 and is owned through an LLC managed by Jake Newell and business partner Ted Hergett of Jonesboro. Newell said the project will have 33 units available for lease with a mixture of two-bedroom, one-bedroom, and studio apartments. He said about a third of those units should be pre-leased before they are move-in ready. The project should be done by early next year. And that does it for today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report. We will report back to you again next Thursday, right here on Ozarks at Large. I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Huntsville. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your Monday.